Russell singing Beware of Darkness. Welcome to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling on KKRN 88.5 FM. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. Unspun tries to unravel the hype and illusions of corporate media through in-depth interviews with truth-tellers and advocates from around the world. We are now streaming live on the internet. Go to kkrn.org, click on the listen button. KKRN is a community radio station supported by listeners and underwriters like yourselves. Your support keeps us on the air, so go to kkrn.org and click on that donate button to support our efforts. Unspun is a call-in show. We invite questions and comments from our listeners. Our number in the studio is 530-337-1885, 530-337-1885. Today, our guest is Dr. Ian Hughes. He is a multifaceted individual with many talents and many interests. Ian Hughes has a doctorate in nuclear physics and has worked in some of the top laboratories in Europe and the U.S. He has trained as a psychoanalyst and is currently doing research on how science can benefit society, both socially and economically. His latest book, Imperfect Design, How Our Psychology Threatens Our World, will soon be released. It explores the roles of psychopaths and sociopaths in society and history. He has an award-winning and informative website and blog at disorderedworld.com. I'm not going to spell that out for you, but I will put a link on our website where I put the archives of this show up so you can find it there. But it is disorderedworld.com. And then he shares on his website excerpts from his new book, and he does a lot of other things, I'm sure, in the world. And I want to welcome Dr. Ian Hughes. Welcome to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling.
Thank you, Doug. Thank you for having me on.
Oh, it is a great pleasure to have you on. Your book is not only fascinating to read, and I want to thank you for providing that manuscript. One of the things that tickled me, I'll start with the things that tickle me, but you had a quote in there from Hafiz, who is one of my favorite poets, and it goes like this: the great religions are the ships, poets the lifeboats. Every sane person I know has jumped overboard. And that just tickled me, and it kind of brought into perspective some of the things that we're going to be talking about. Let's go to some basics so our listeners have a place to maybe start in with this discussion. Your research and your book, they focus on the role of certain psychological disorders in our leadership of our nations and how that has affected us both historically and also currently. And so I would appreciate it if you would give our listeners a brief explanation of the specific disorders that you've been studying and writing about and the ways that they shape our society.
Okay. I guess one way to get started is my background, as you know, Doug, is in science. And one of the passions, I guess, for writing the book was I think that science has now discovered something that is one of the most important things, I think, that we've ever discovered. Freud famously said that three great emotions had happened, three great advances in science had happened that really changed our perspective on the world. And he talked about the first one being Nicholas Copernicus and how Copernicus discovered that the Earth wasn't the center of the universe. The second one was Darwin, and of course the discovery of evolution, that we're not specially created species, but really part of nature. And then Freud characteristically described his own discovery of the unconscious as being the third discovery that completely changed our perspective in the world. So I think what I'm writing about in the book is the discovery of psychologists and psychiatrists recently of this small proportion of people in our society, in every society, that has this small number of personality disorders. And those personality disorders, there are three of them that I write about in the book. The first one is psychopathy. The second one is paranoid personality disorder. And the third is narcissistic personality disorder. So, personality disorders, what are they? There are around about 12 personality disorders that psychologists, psychiatrists have identified. And most of these really are no danger to other people. Most personality disorders, for example, if you take obsessive-compulsive disorder or depressive personality disorder, those are personality disorders that have more harm and upset to the person who has the disorder than they have to the people around them. But the three personality disorders that I'm focusing on are ones which I call dangerous personality disorders, because they really have the behavior and the mindset of the people with these disorders really represents a threat to the people around them and to societies in general. So I think this, when I talk about this being a monumental discovery in science, I think the discovery that a small proportion of people who suffer from these psychologically abnormal personalities dominate the normal majority, and the differences between that minority and the rest of us are sufficient that you could classify this minority almost as a different type of human being. And again, if we go back to Freud, in Civilization and Its Discontents, Freud talked about the definition of civilization, if you like, is that civilization exists, in Freud's words, to try and contain the violence and the propensity of humanity for violence. But this realization, I think, is that there are a minority in every society for whom that civilization isn't possible. Their personalities are such that they are not capable of living in a civilized manner with the rest of humanity.
And this small minority, it's a very small minority, or are they fairly common in everyday life? Or are we going to meet these personalities in our everyday life? Are they a very small minority, or are they pretty large?
Well, the minority, at the moment, the best estimate for, say, for psychopathy is around about 1% in the population. So Robert Herr, who is one of the main psychiatrists who writes about this, says that psychopaths are responsible for over half violent crime. So that gives you some idea, although they're a small minority, they have a massive impact on crime statistics, a massive impact on the level of violence within society. And narcissists, if you like, I think percentage there is estimated around 2%. And with paranoid personality disorder, that is around about 4% are the best estimates at the moment. But maybe if I can describe a little bit more about the characteristics of these personality disorders, because I think it's not just a matter of the title of my book is Imperfect Design. And the title is chosen deliberately in that it's not just the characteristics of the minority with these three personality disorders that's important. It's also the characteristics of everyone else's psychology and how the rest of us have certain characteristics that to, if you like, look to these people with respect, often put power in their hands, and often help them in terms of the evil that they perpetrate. So maybe if I just spend a very short time just describing each of the three in a little more detail.
Certainly, I think that would be helpful, yeah.
For psychopaths, the main characteristics are a lack of empathy. So for psychopaths, they have, the way I've described it in the book is that as infants, one of the characteristics of infants is that they respond to their mother or to those around them in emotional dialogue, in emotional conversation. So they respond to their mother's happiness with smiles of their own. They respond to fear with fear of their own. So this is emotional communication, and particularly in terms of empathy. And that empathy is missing in psychopaths. So psychopaths, at a certain stage of our development as infants, we learn that the difference between people and things is that people respond to us in emotional ways. So people respond to us very differently than a child would respond to us, for example. But for psychopaths, that difference never develops. So psychopaths look at people in the same way as they look at things. And I write about in the book how that has horrific consequences in terms of how the ability of psychopaths to deal with people or to kill them and so forth, and with absolute lack of conscience and absolute lack of empathy. So with narcissists have a different personality disorder, which is one in which their mind is shaped to only allow them to believe that they are important. So narcissists are unable and psychologically incapable of perceiving of the idea of equality. And I think that has huge implications. You know, for most of history, we've lived in unequal societies. For most of history, we've lived in societies where there were kings and queens and emperors and so forth. So the development of more equal societies, democracy and so forth, has been pretty bad news for narcissists, because they begin to live in societies where it is demanded of them that they act as equals and give rights to others on the same basis of themselves. But for narcissists, their minds are frozen in this perspective that they are more important than anyone, more entitled to wealth and power than anyone else. And so, as I say, the concept of equality is something that is completely alien to them. And finally, with paranoid personality disorder, people with that disorder also, you can think of in terms of a frozen state of mind. And again, if we go back to early child development, psychologists say that there are two states of mind that we have as very small children. One of those states of mind is this paranoid state of mind, where the world is a very dangerous place and we are very frightened of everything around us. And the second state of mind, which we gradually learn to move into, is one in which, while the world may still be frightening, we're able to contain that fear, and we're able to start to think about things around us and not just react in terms of threat and violence. But again, with people with paranoid personality disorder, their minds are frozen in this hypersensitive or hyper-alert state in which they see others as a threat and are incapable of seeing anyone else as anything other than a threat.
Let me take a second here to remind our listeners, you're listening to Unspun on Experiment Truth Telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. With us today on the phone in Dublin, Ireland, is Ian Hughes, nuclear physicist, psychologist, and author. And we're discussing the roles of abnormal personalities in our world and what we can do to retain and return to a more sane world. We invite your questions and comments. Call in at 337-1885, 337-1885. That's our studio number. And you might think about making a pledge at the same time, and we'll actually triple your pledge with matching donors this morning. So make that call, 337-1885. You talk about these specific personality disorders. Do they happen? Well, actually, this is kind of a two-part question. First of all, I'm interested in whether this is genetically related, or is this something that happens because they're not nurtured in childhood? Do we have any idea of the factors that actually create these personalities? And my other second part of that question is, do these disorders occur simultaneously in the same people?
those are good questions, and I think the second one is very important. I'll explain when I come on to, maybe when we talk about Stalin and Mao and Hitler and so on. They had multiple personality disorders. In terms of the first question, there is a lot of uncertainty as to the causes, and a lot of controversy even around the delineation and definitions of what these personality disorders are. The only thing that can be said for certainty is that the causes of these personality disorders is partly genetic and partly nurture. So, as with anything in terms of genetics, you know, geneticists would sort of stress that genetics isn't destiny, even though people may have genes for certain diseases or disorders, that doesn't necessarily mean that they will develop a particular disease or a particular disorder. So that nature almost, whether it's personality disorders or whether it's disease, it's almost always a combination of the two. And I think that's as much as the psychologist can say at the moment in terms of these disorders. In terms of your second question, it's absolutely the case that these disorders are often sort of coexisting within the one individual. So, for example, if you take Stalin, I think both Stalin and Mao would have had, obviously, psychopathic personality disorder. Their disdain for their citizens in their own countries, the murder of millions that they carried out, and what is documented about what they said in terms of what they knew they were doing, it's clear that they were psychopathic. I think Stalin was more paranoid than Mao was. So, for example, the history of the Great Terror in Russia, Stalin, from the moment that he got power, had wave after wave of massacres that were designed to get rid of the mixed enemy. So there's an excessive paranoia on Stalin's part that there was always a new enemy that had to be annihilated. I think in Mao's case, it was much more... Mao was extremely narcissistic. I think narcissism was probably stronger in him than it would have been in Stalin. And that narcissism came through in terms of his vision for Chinese society and the length to which he was going to go in order to make his vision a reality. So famously, he said, half of China may have to die in order for him, his plans for China, to come to fruition. But the most dangerous, as I say, these personality disorders can be dangerous in their own right, but when they come together in one personality, then that's particularly lethal.
You point out, that's an interesting part of your book because so many of us haven't taken a close look at that era when Stalin and Mao were ruling their countries so brutally. But I see in America and also almost all the Western nations, but America and the UK specifically, I see some of these same sort of traits. And it's easy to look back in history and maybe point a finger at the obvious people that are destructive that are sick people that were in charge of their countries. But when we have to look at, I think we need to look at ourselves currently too. And I was going to ask you your opinion, and I know it would be difficult for you to give a true opinion, but I see people like Dick Cheney and Tony Blair as maybe qualifying as psychopathic elite or displaying some of these kind of characteristics, and their effect on our societies has been pretty damaging. And I just wanted to maybe open up that part of the discussion and get your opinion.
So the first thing I'd say really is, when you say that, in a sense it's easy to point at the monsters of history, if you like, and look at things a little bit in the past, you'll know from what I've written that most of what I've written is about sort of more historical up until the 60s or so, or a little bit before that in terms of Stalin and Mao and so on. And I've deliberately avoided going further than that into contemporary issues. And there's a reason that I'm doing that, in that there's a danger. There's a lot of documented evidence around Mao and Stalin and Hitler and so on. And the scale of their crimes, both domestically and foreign in terms of Hitler and so on, are such that it's, in building the case, it's almost irrefutable that these people had these disorders. I think once we come into more contemporary events where the documentation is not yet, or the research maybe is not yet there to that extent, there's a danger, I think, depending on what side we're on, that we say, this person is a psychopath. Because in one instance, without the psychological the diagnosis, we can't be sure. And there's a danger that it degenerates into finger-pointing and each side saying, no, your hero is a psychopath, or your leader is a psychopath, and ours isn't. So I deliberately have kept away from more contemporary events for that reason, because in the first instance, I'm trying to get this idea about the damage that personality disorders have accepted, if you like, across, regardless of what people's current political beliefs are. Because I think the real divide that there is in societies, the real divide that there is in humanity, isn't one between particular political parties. It's not one between particular nationalities or one between religions and so forth. The real division is across, within each of those categories, between those who have these psychological abnormalities and the rest of humanity. And so that's one answer I give. The second, I think, in terms of a historical thing, which is sometimes more difficult, I think, when we come to more contemporary events, is that my argument is that for most of history, people with these personality disorders have held power. For most of history, the level of economic development was such that most people lived in abject poverty. Most people were living in rural areas. There wasn't collective, people that being able to organize in unions, for example. So for most of history, we were living in situations that left us at the very vulnerable to domination by people with these personality disorders. With countries that had, I think, a real change happened around the Industrial Revolution and the start of economic growth, start of real economic growth in history, first in Britain, then in Europe, and then in the United States, where the levels of the social and technological changes that began to happen enabled the psychological normal majority to begin to get educated, to begin to work together, to begin to form collective political parties and unions and so on, as I say, that began to oppose the power of this psychological elite, psychologically abnormal elite. And so this has happened to various extents around the world. The poorer nations are still at a fairly early stage of that and are still very vulnerable to domination by psychopaths. Whereas as countries become more developed and have more resources, then they're able to put in place defences against these elites. And I've talked about in the book how the number of different stages that and defences that we've put in place, for example, the rule of law that applies to everyone, regardless of their wealth or power, electoral democracy, which allows us to, if people do get into power who are psychologically disordered, it allows us the opportunity to replace them. The separation of church and state, which takes away the excuse or the rallying cry that any evil is being done in the name of God. Social democracy, which is about the redistribution of wealth in order to maintain a certain minimum standard of living for everyone. Human rights legislation, and so forth. And I think so, in Britain and in the United States, a lot of these protections are in place that have been fought for. I mean, a lot of these things came out of, for example, human rights legislation, the United Nations Declaration on Human Rights came out of the horror of the Second World War. But most of them have come out of violent struggles. But they are in place in, as I say, in United States and Europe and in Britain. The question which I think you rightly raise is one about whether they're being undermined. And the Irish writer Colm Tobin has said that the Taliban is coming at us, always coming at us in one way or another, or the MP Tony Blair says that it's for every generation to reclaim and defend what has been won. And so I think while those defences have been put in place, I agree with you that there are signs both in the United States, Britain, and so forth, that we are in a dangerous time in terms of the backlash and how those defences are being undermined.
Let me interrupt you here. We do have a caller on the air, and I wanted to bring him on and see if he had a question for you. Randy, you're on the air. Randy, are you there? Hold on. I got to get the rest of the technical there. All my duckies in a row. Randy, are you there?
Yes. Sorry.
Yes.
Okay. You know, listening to this conversation is really scary. And recently I came across this YouTube video, a time lapse of every nuclear explosion since 1945 by an artist, a Japanese artist. And I don't know if anybody else has seen that. But my question is, we're assuming that our leaders are responsible people. But if we watch this time lapse video, we can see the nuclear energy. I mean, nuclear explosions are just have been out of control, and so what are the chances that we will have a nuclear war? Our guest, does he have any idea about what he would personally think the chances are of just a nuclear war ahead of us?
Okay, good question, Randy.
Okay.
Do you want to stay on the line or?
No, you know, I'll just go back to listening.
All right, thank you, Randy. Thanks for the question.
Yeah,
bye. So, thanks, Randy. Thanks for the question. I guess I grew up in the 60s, 70s, and so on, and it was a very palpable sense of the danger of nuclear war. Remember that one of the things that got me into science in the first instance was Carl Sagan's Cosmos television program. And one of those television programs was about the level of nuclear arsenal that the United States and Soviet Union had, you know, the tonnage of nuclear explosives for every man, woman, and child on the planet. And that was a very real fear for me when I was growing up. Every time a siren went off and so forth, you would think this would be in the back of your mind and so on. So the threat of nuclear war was very real in the 60s and 70s. I think after the end of the Cold War, that has receded. But some of the research that I've been doing on personality disorders has got me frightened again. In particular, if you think about Adolf Hitler, and you understand Hitler's personality, Hitler was very successful up until 1939. You know, he got into power, he had a lot of support from the German people, because he was introducing a lot of programs in terms of unemployment, welfare, in terms of health system. He was putting lots of people back to work, mostly through the rearmament of Germany. And up until 1939, when he invaded Poland, he had achieved everything peacefully, more or less peacefully. After 1939, his real intentions became clear. And he launched a war of annihilation against Poland and the former states of the Soviet Union, and of course the Holocaust against the Jews. In reading about Hitler, you see that there was nothing that was going to stop him from doing either of those two things. And in fact, when Hitler and the German forces were held in Stalingrad, Hitler made the decision that his dream was both to be the Emperor of Europe, to annihilate the Soviet Union and so on, but his second dream was to annihilate the Jews. And he realized at the time of whenever the German forces were started to be pushed back from the Soviet Union, he made the choice that his priority was to kill the Jews, because he thought he was doing mankind a favor by doing that. And nothing would have stopped him from doing so. So when you see what Hitler did in the Holocaust, and you realize that the determination, and it's not determination in the normal psychological sense, nothing was going to stop him from doing this. And then you think that nuclear weapons could be in the hands of someone with that type of personality, we should be scared.
Yeah, well, we have several countries in the world we have to consider, including the U.S., Pakistan, and India. They both have nuclear weapons.
North Korea, of course.
Oh, yeah, North Korea. We wonder about that personality there. Let me take a second here because it is the bottom of the hour. I want to just remind our listeners, you're listening to Unspun, an Experiment in Truth-Telling. With us today is Dr. Ian Hughes, physicist, author, researcher, psychologist, and we're talking with him from Dublin, Ireland, on the phone, and you're welcome to call in. Our number is 337-1885, 337-1885. We also are in the middle of our pledge drive, and we need to get your support. So call in or go to our website, kkrn.org, and you can make a donation there. I want to thank all of the people that have already donated, and I also want to thank our underwriters at this time. We have one more event, which is tomorrow when our pledge drive ends. That's a pancake breakfast here in Round Mountain from 8 until noon. Great food. A lot of people from the community, usually over 100 people, show up. It's a lot of fun and a good chance to visit with your neighbors and discuss things and just have fun with the family. So come down tomorrow afternoon, Sunday morning, and join in the pancake breakfast with us. Getting back to our discussion, I think, you alluded to how these people with these psychological disorders affect their country. I mean, obviously, a number of people had to go along with Hitler for the Holocaust to happen, and I could point out even other things in our collective psyche. One of them that comes to mind is the idea of American exceptionalism, which seems to be a form of nationalistic narcissism that is affecting how we operate in the world. Can societies collectively have these same disorders or be led into these places by these psychopathic elite that take control of our countries on a regular basis?
I think they can certainly set the tone of culture, or they can set the dominant culture. So that's certainly, again, in the book I talk about, if you think about the racism, for example, which was absolutely taken for granted for most of history, from the transatlantic slave trade through to the British Empire, where Churchill, even during the Second World War, Churchill said in the discussion around having a clause in the Declaration of Human Rights about racism, Churchill famously said he made no apologies for Anglo-Saxon superiority because Anglo-Saxons were superior. So I think that also in terms of sexism, the attitudes towards women and so forth, there are, I think these things come through in the dominant culture. But as I say, with economic development, with the safeguards that we put in place in order to get the dominant culture changed from that of this minority to the culture that's more reflective of the majority, then I think you see these changes happening. I think in terms of nationalism that you mentioned, that was one of the major lessons that the European countries learned from the catastrophe of the Second World War. Now, the formation of the European Economic Community first and then the European Union was the first time that former enemies pooled sovereignty in order to reduce nationalism and in order to prevent future war. So I think nationalism can be a very dangerous thing in terms of having insiders and outsiders. That very much, as you say, it plays into not only narcissism, it also plays into paranoia, in that the insiders are good and the outsiders are the enemy. So, as I say, there are forms of nationalism which can be positive in terms of a positive self-image and a positive sense of community, but if it's taken too far, then it can be exploited by these people for their own ends, and their own ends is always to stay in power.
Let me interrupt here again. We have another caller, and I want to take his call And I always like to take the calls from our callers because they open up different areas that maybe we hadn't thought about, and they kind of make some of these conversations actually bloom. So I'm going to take this call. Rocky, you're on the air.
Good morning, Doug.
Good morning, Rocky.
Thank you for your program. I'd like to have your guest comment on mass psychopathic behavior in regards to religion. And we got Judaism, Islam, and Christianity all looking forward to some kind of an apocalyptic happening in the future. And they live for this. I mean, we got the evangelical Christians and radical Islam and Judaism. You know, you look what's happening in Israel today. And how do you address that mass psychopathic behavior? And I'll take my
good question. Good question. Thanks, Rock.
Thanks, Rocky.
Yeah, he's off.
I think it's
go ahead.
The first thing that comes to mind is Sam Harris. It's a quote from Sam Harris, where he said that both the Bible and the Quran contain much that is life-affirming, much that is very positive, much that we can learn from, but both also contain mountains of life-threatening gibberish. And I think that's one of the issues about the difficulties in dealing with religion is, first of all, there's a myriad of religions, but also within religion, there is a mixture, and I think it's a lethal mixture, of love and hate. So in almost every religion, you'll get lots of exhortations to love thy neighbor, you know, be kind to other people, and so forth, on one hand. And then on the other hand, you have, you know, kill those who do not believe, kill those who do not obey, and so forth. So this combination of the positive and the threatening, I think, is a lethal combination. And so, in fact, in the book, I write about religion as being one of the most reliable, if you like, means for psychopaths and people with paranoid personality and narcissists to get into positions of authority. There are a number of features of religion which almost make it a perfect recipe for tyrannical rule. And I'll just run through. There are four things that I've mentioned about characteristics of almost every religion that these religions all share in common, but that make it, as I say, the perfect recipe for tyrannical rule. The first of these is the claim that religions have an absolute truth. So that whatever it is, Christianity, Catholicism, Protestantism, they know what the truth is. The fact that these truths are mutually exclusive or contradictory makes no difference. They all claim to have absolute truth. The second point is their insistence that the proof isn't necessary in order for you to have to believe. So I think it was A.C. Grayling who said that religious claims are irrefutable because they're untestable. And so this insistence that we don't need proof, it's revelation or it's the word of God, and therefore we don't need what we tell you is correct and you must believe, is also a very dangerous and also a very unscientific, goes without saying, premise. The third dangerous aspect that religions share in common is their widespread use of censorship in order to stifle dissent. The Salman Rushdie is one recent example or victim of that. And then finally, many religions, have the threat of ultimate sanction for those who dissent or refuse to believe or who disagree. So I think these characteristics, claim an absolute truth, insistence that proof is necessary, use of censorship, and threat of ultimate sanction, mean that a lot of religious dogma, regardless of whether, as you say, whether it's Christian, whether it's Judaism, whether it's Islam, or as we're seeing in Burma, for example, or in normally peaceful Buddhism, these are a perfect recipe for the unwavering certainty of the narcissist. I'm absolutely right. It's the word of God, and I know that. The ruthless inhumanity of the psychopath, if you disagree, you're dead. And also for paranoid personality disorder, to be the cheerleaders of hate for those who disagree. So scapegoating Jews, for example, scapegoating those who are of a different religion. So I agree that with your caller's question, that religion can be a very potent weapon for those with personality disorder. But I would also say, this isn't to say that religion is of no value. I mean, most people in the world have religious beliefs. It is clear that people take a lot of value or put a lot of value in religion. And I wouldn't argue against that. You know, religion addresses some of humanity's ultimate concerns in terms of right and wrong, what happens after death, you know, good and evil, and so forth. So it's not religion, all of religion, that is the problem. It is the mix of, this potent mix of the positive aspects of religion that appeal to the majority, and these other aspects of religion that can be used by people with these disorders to manipulate the majority for their own ends.
Well, Ian, we've got another caller. Apparently, you're real popular out there. So I'm going to bring on this other caller. Dennis, you're on the air. Did you have a question for Dr. Ian Hughes?
Oh, hi. My name's Dennis. And, one of the things that I've observed in my life is the tendency of, especially in schools, and in certain situations, like crisis, is when there's always a pack leader or a tendency for, a thug or kind of taking charge of the situation when there's chaos or a crisis that happened in Louisiana, in Katrina. And it's I think it points to what you're saying, Ian, about that minority, the pathological, that sees that opportunity. And also, I see that in the world, at least notionally, that to prevent that from happening, in my case personally, I had to push back. If you don't push back, you're toast. In some cases it works, some cases not so good. But I'd like to have your opinion on the situation where the United States, I think primarily after World War II, became kind of the pack leader of the world, in a sense, metaphorically. The world cop kind of thing. People want to now pull back that role. And my concern is, when you do that, the Putins and the forces in China, for example, or North Korea, you create a vacuum of leadership, and it's going to get filled by a thug or some pathological regime. So you have a balance between how do you keep these folks at bay? I mean, from a practical standpoint in the world, and what's the role of the U.S. In that situation?
Okay, well, a good question. Give Dr. Hughes a chance to answer that. Did you want to stay on the air, Dennis, or did you want to listen to the answer?
I'll stay on the air. I'll stay and keep, you know.
Okay. All right, Ian, did you have a response?
Yeah. Thanks, Dennis. I think you're raising a couple of very interesting and very difficult questions. I mean, the first thing I'd say is around your observation of whenever there's a crisis, a thug will step forward. I'm glad you raised that issue because, again, when we talk about this minority and how they interact with the psychology of the rest of us, what happens in crisis situations, and you can see it, for example, in the Russian Revolution, you can see it in what happened when Hitler came to power in Cambodia and so forth. One of the secrets of how this minority achieve power and maintain power is that they bring about a segregation of society, a stratification of society into the psychological minority in power over the psychological majority. And so it happens in every town and village. It's not just a matter of them seizing power in the center. They then authorize or send signals to, and the local thugs react. So Arnold Dufikus has a very good example of this in Soviet, in the collectivization in Russia. Whenever Stalin started to send out the gangs that would enforce collectivization, and he talked about one particular local thug who had been begging on the streets for up until this time. He was a no one in the village, but once he was empowered to act violently against him, and a handful of others were empowered to act violently against all of their neighbors, the rest of the neighbors had no defense. So I think that issue that you're raising about bullies and thugs suddenly come to the fore in situations of crisis is you're observing this stratification of society into the abnormal minority and the normal majority. The second question you ask is how do we react? And we're in a quandary. We have a real problem here, because in the first instance, our natural instinct is to react violently, is to try and seize back power. But if we take a violent route, for the majority, violence isn't the natural. You know, violence and thuggery and so on aren't our natural way of acting. They are the natural way of acting of this minority. So as soon as we go into that, we begin a violent situation, we are moving off the playing field that we feel comfortable on, and we're moving on to the playing field where they are experts. And I think once the violence starts, the majority are the loser. I've seen this in Northern Ireland when I was growing up in the troubles in Northern Ireland. Because what happens is, in the Northern Ireland situation, it's Catholics and Protestants, the middle, the sort of liberal or the inclusive, or the, what's the word I'm struggling for, the those who are seeking the middle ground, are sidelined, because as soon as the violence starts, everyone gets frightened, and everyone lines up behind their own brand of psychopath for protection. So we're in a real quandary in terms of when crisis happens, these bullies come to the fore, but if we react violently, we're in trouble. So that's why I think the leadership that, for example, that Gandhi has given, that Aung San Suu Kyi has given in Burma and so forth, is that we have to resist them, but we have to resist them very often in non-violent ways. That, because we are the majority, the numbers are on our side. So I think, personally, I believe that non-violence is ultimately the most effective way to deal with them. I think that, again, was it Aung San Suu Kyi who said that violence can create a different society, but it's more likely to create a more violent society. And I think, Doug, from a lot of the people that you would have interviewed on your shows before, you see, I think America's reaction after 9/11 in many ways has been to adopt some of the tactics of the enemy, in terms of the illegal rendition, or the war in Iraq and so forth, illegal war in Iraq and so forth. The violence has really had an effect of polarizing and acting as a recruiting agent against America. And I would argue that it hasn't been effective, the reaction, a lot of the reaction that America had to 9/11. And I'd say, again, that's a classical example of, in one sense, it's an understandable reaction after what happened. But again, as I think it was Mark Danner in his New York Review of Books articles was saying, there were choices that people in power in America made at that time. To start a war on terror that would terrorize states into not daring to stand up against America. But I think a lot of the evidence shows that that hasn't been successful.
Well, one question to interject. In the case of Hitler and his attack on Europe and Poland and so forth, how would you stop that situation nonviolently? How do you stop a force that he has produced that wants to basically take over Europe and whatever nonviolently, without putting in, as we did, and take him out?
Okay. Yeah. And I have other questions for you. So, Dennis, I'm going to I'm going to drop you off the line right now and let Dr. Hughes answer that, and then we have some other questions, okay?
Okay, all right.
Thanks for calling. All right, bye. Go ahead.
Again, Dennis, I don't have an easy answer, because I think we have to believe in the defenses. You know, this is a struggle that's been going on for at least 200 years since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, where it really got going. We have to learn the lessons that our forefathers learned very, very painfully, and we have to believe in them. We have to believe in the rule of law. We have to keep, you know, we have to believe in electoral democracy and in separation of church and state. We have to defend those values. We have to believe in social democracy, that we need social security systems that stop people getting into. But that applies in an international level as well, yeah, in terms of that. We can't live in a peaceful world when so much of the world is still in abject poverty. Yeah. We have to set our target in terms of the principles and the lessons that we've learned about how to defend ourselves against these people, and we have to act in concert with that. So in terms of, we have to stop doing things like sending arms to tyrannies, we have to stop doing things that provide support to dictators and so on. But there's no easy answer. But we have made a lot of progress in terms of putting the defenses in place, and we have to understand the danger that we face and believe in the defenses that we have currently at our disposal.
Yeah, let me bring Willie here in the studio has a question for you, so I'm going to bring up his mic and let him ask his question also. Willie, you're on the air.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Hughes, for being here. Paranoid, the nuclear catastrophe in Japan, is that the appropriate place for our paranoia? Are we at times this being hyper alert to the fear of nuclear energy and nuclear catastrophe, actually?
Yeah, good question.
Thank you.
Yeah.
To rephrase the question, maybe we're fearful of things we shouldn't be, and maybe we're not fearful enough of things that we should be fearful of.
I think people... There are obvious dangers with nuclear energy, but those dangers, I think, you know, they're based on, in one sense, they're easier to deal with, because we can learn from an accident and find out what happened and put things in place that mitigate against that happening again. I think the bigger dangers come from people, and again, Doug, with your interview with Greg Palast, you highlighted that in terms of if the failure was one of covering up. The safety mechanisms weren't actually going to function. That isn't a failure of technology, that's a failure of people. So I think in response, the things that would frighten me more are about these types of individuals and the devastation that they've already caused, the way that they've already shaped history, and the way that they continue to do so.
Let me. We only have about 5 minutes left in the show, maybe a little less. And there's one other area. Actually, let's just switch over to, because we've dwelled on the negative part of this, and you've touched on the things that we can do. You mentioned in your book the Declaration, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And Eleanor Roosevelt is one of my favorite people, and she was very big proponent of that. And so maybe we can spend the rest of this time here until we hear the music at the end. That's our cue to wind down. But how about expanding on those things, that the positive things that we have available to us that we can, work as a majority to make a more powerful factor in what's going on in our world that you brought up. But the human rights, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights is one of them. I'm sure there's more, but I'm going to let you just finish out this interview with those thoughts.
Yeah. Well, I guess just to reiterate some of the things that I said around the values that and the defenses and the values that we have put in place and that our people who have gone before us have struggled to put in place. I guess the Western, what's known as the Western model of democracy, which is representative democracy, which was began in the United States, the separation of church and state, which was a really, I think, an essential and a huge step forward, and Thomas Jefferson taking a lot of the credit for that. And you can see in countries where that doesn't happen, for example, in Saudi Arabia or in Iran and so forth, the difficulties that there are for people living in states where there isn't a separation between religion and the state. So that's a hugely positive step forward in allowing, multiple viewpoints, multiculturalism and so forth. Then the big step forward that happened in Europe after the end of the Second World War was the model of social democracy, which, again, I think it was the French socialist Jean Jaurès who said that social democracy was the best means ever devised for peaceful social change. And I like that their definition of democracy better than Churchill's definition of democracy, which is it's the best system apart from, or the worst system apart from all the rest. I think social democracy, in which it was recognized that capitalism needed to be kept under control, that inequality couldn't be allowed to grow to levels that left masses of people destitute, and there needed to be social security systems and so forth that allowed a minimum standard of living, ensured a minimum standard of living for every citizen. So that model of social democracy, which came out after the war, as you mentioned in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which in the book I say it's a magnificent step forward in terms of how humanity deals with ethics. Up until the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, humanity invariably turned to religion for ethical guidance. I think the Universal Declaration of Human Rights is a much stronger basis for ethical conduct than anything that's written in religion. It draws a lot on what's written in many religions, but I think it's a real step change in terms of that every individual has these rights, and no state or other person has the right to violate them. And I think that's actually, in terms of psychology, it's also interesting, because that's the basis to allow every individual to develop to their full potential. And that's a wonderful thing to think of for the future.
Well, Ian, that music you hear in the background is our cue. We've only got a minute here. And I want to thank you for being on Unspun and Experiment in Truth-Telling today. We will put links to your website and your blog, and also I really look forward to talking more with you. And maybe when your book is published, you can come and visit us again, because obviously we had a whole lot more to talk about. But we'll have to end it here for today. And Ian, thank you very much for being on Unspun. You got that standing ovation from Willie.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much, Doug. Much appreciated.
Our pleasure and our honor. Thank you once again. Well, that was Ian Hughes, physicist, psychologist, author of Imperfect Design, How Our Psychology Threatens Our World. We really have to move along here. I'm just going to say one more time before I move on to the next part of our regular programming that this is our Pledge Drive week. Call in 337-1885, 337-1885.